In the meantime, this KABU program has been made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from Back to Back Cafe, a worker-owned collective featuring fair trade, shade-grown organic coffee, pastries, and vegetarian food. Back to Back Cafe is open Monday through Saturday and is located at 6th and East Burnside. More information at 503-233-1929. And also by the Portland Alliance, the city's oldest alternative progressive newspaper, reporting on issues ignored or distorted by corporate-dominated media and providing a voice for social justice activists, environmentalists, trade unionists, and the progressive community. Information at 503-239-4991 or theportlandalliance.org. Here comes the Old Mole Variety Hour.
I wish I was a mole in the ground. Yes, I wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. You are listening to KBOO Portland, Oregon, 90.7, listener-supported community radio. It's time now for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Denise Morris, your host for this February 27th Monday. Tammy Dean is our engineer. Good morning, Tammy. Well, we're getting right to it this morning. We've got a pretty jam-packed show, I think a good one. And what you'll be hearing from us is Bill Resnick interviewing Chris Tonsig. He's the editor of Middle East Report. They will be talking about The Clash of Barbarisms, and unfortunately that's not a movie title, that's a reality we're facing. Fran Michel will bring us a little look at the sale of our U.S. ports and the Bush administration's clinging to claims of racism. We'll also hear from Erica Steinbauer. She's co-founder of CAUSA, Oregon's Immigrant Rights Coalition. We'll be talking about an upcoming event this weekend. But first, we're switching it up a bit this morning. We're going to start with Old Mole Lori Mercier. She has a guest, James Gregory, professor of history at University of Washington, and he will discuss his new book, The Southern Diaspora, How the Great Migrations of Black and White Southerners Transformed America. Lori?
Thanks, Denise. Jim Gregory, are you there?
I'm here. Hi, Lori.
Welcome to KABU. Let me say a few words of introduction before we discuss your book. James Gregory, professor of history at University of Washington and author of another book, a prize-winning book entitled American Exodus, The Dust Bowl Migration and Okie Culture in California. And Gregory is currently working on a study of the twilight of American socialism about Upton Sinclair and the fate of radical politics. And together with his students at UW, he has created some terrific websites on the 1919 Seattle General Strike, labor and radical newspapers in the Pacific Northwest, communism in Washington State, and the Seattle civil rights and labor movements. And Jim, we'll have to have you back sometime to talk about some of those websites.
I'd love to.
Well, let's get to your book, The Southern Diaspora, How the Great Migrations of Black and White Southerners Transformed America. And you write that between 1900 and 1980, more than 20 million white and black Southerners left their region looking for jobs in the North and West. Why did you choose to write about this migration, and what is its significance for understanding the United States today?
Well, you know, migration is one of the great forces of human history, and we often don't think very much about it in the United States context. We think about people coming to our nation from other places, but the moving around that we Americans have done has been part of what has made our history what it is, and particularly the movement of Southerners, and particularly Black Southerners out of that region into the cities of the North and the West has enabled much of the political changes that make America today. All of the civil rights reorganizations, the civil rights movements were made possible by that movement out of the South. And a lot of other things, including conservative movements of today, owe their origins to the fact that millions of Southerners left that region and distributed themselves throughout the United States. So it's almost the hidden story, I think, one of those kind of things that Americans haven't thought about that has been so fundamental to our history.
Or so obvious and under our nose that we don't recognize the significance of this migration.
Exactly.
Well, let's talk first about this African-American migration and how it affected American politics and culture. And first, dealing with this intriguing theme that you present about the influence on the civil rights movement. As you note, two out of every three of these black immigrants lived in one of eight major cities, New York, Philadelphia, Chicago, St. Louis, Los Angeles, San Francisco, etc. And how did this concentration of immigration affect the development of later political and social movements?
Well, the civil rights reorganizations of the 20th century are the great story of what has changed about America domestically in the last century. But
okay, we're going to try to get James Gregory back on the line. I'm not sure what happened here. Stay tuned. We're going to try to get James Gregory back on the line. Let's hear some music, Tammy. Maybe some Muddy Waters again. Sorry about that, Jim. I don't know what happened.
The line went dead.
But we were just listening to a bit of Muddy Waters, and we're going to come back and talk about this cultural transformation that this immigration brought about. But you were telling us about the influence of this immigration on the formation of the civil rights struggles of the 40s, 50s, and 60s.
Well, one of the things that I wanted to think about is how is it that a relatively tiny minority, African Americans, about 13% of the population, were able to turn the American nation away from its historic commitment to white supremacy and towards a more different kind of framework of law that emphasizes equality, you know, what we think of as the civil rights movements and struggles, and how is it that that was able to succeed? And it required some really unique political opportunities, and what I discovered is that those opportunities really only existed in certain places, the big cities of the North, and only at a certain time in American history when those big cities enjoyed real access to the presidential power and congressional authority. And so it was an act of great fortune, I guess you'd say, that African Americans moved out of the South, where they were powerless and were going to remain powerless, into the big cities, where they could develop in very complicated ways some leverage that enabled them to get this civil rights transformation started. So the geography of American politics is a big part of what I think is really important to understand, and I try to develop in this book.
And you also tell a story that's quite different from one that we've heard about these northern black communities as places of opportunity rather than oppressive ghettos where people are victimized by low wages and dismal prospects. I mean, there's actually quite a lot of creative a flourishing of creative activity and also institution building. And what are some of these institutions that enabled those political struggles to prosper?
Well, they were ghettos, and they were places of limited opportunity and great poverty and serious racial oppression. But at the same time, they enabled kind of a political and cultural fluorescence. So there's a difference between the economic opportunities, which were limited in the ghettos, and the political and cultural possibilities that did develop there, where African Americans were able to develop big music industries, blues and jazz, and ultimately rock and roll, and much of American popular music depends on Southerners, black Southerners, bringing those music forms north where they can become commercialized and where African Americans can get credit for the first time for developing a cultural resource that white Americans will appreciate as well. And in the northern cities, the literary renaissance, we often talk about the Harlem Renaissance, but the production of different kinds of publishing and literature is possible for African Americans. So there's a cultural process that goes alongside with the political mobilization of those cities. So it makes those, you know, the term that journalists of the 1920s and 30s used was black metropolis, because they were excited by the power and prospects of New York and Chicago and Detroit and other cities that had large black populations. So I've rescued that term, and I think it needs to be used alongside of the concept of the ghetto. So a place where there are economic limitations, but cultural and political possibilities.
Well, let's talk some more about this cultural development and how this African-American migration really did transform American popular culture. And you actually talk about a couple of examples, I think, that would be well known to our listeners, including Aretha Franklin and the influence of her father. Maybe you could talk a bit more about the Franklin family and their experiences in Detroit.
Aretha is born in Memphis, and then as a young child, I think 3 years old, she comes north with her family. Her father's a preacher, a Baptist preacher, and he takes over leadership of the New Bethel Baptist Church in Detroit and builds it into one of the most largest and most famous black churches in Detroit. And then he becomes, by the 1950s, one of the leading black evangelists going around the country. So he's right in the heart of this sort of building religious enterprise that is also tied into the music institutions that African Americans are developing in the North. And Aretha Franklin is, you know, sort of the embodiment of that, the queen of soul. By the mid-1960s, she grows up in this atmosphere of Detroit, where there's gospel music and jazz and religion, and African Americans are really building something that is going to transform American culture.
What about Muddy Waters?
Chicago blues. Chicago is the home of the blues. It's not where the blues music form is invented. That really comes out of the Mississippi Delta, and jazz, you know, is also out of it. But it's in Chicago that blues and jazz in New York are commercialized and made into something that that will be, you know, the strain of American popular music of the 20th century. And Muddy Waters is one of the engineers of that.
And there is a connection, isn't there, between this kind of cultural fluorescence and the political fluorescence that also takes place at this time?
Absolutely, because it's all about the building up of pride and presenting African-American contributions to American society in a way that gains credibility for the community, and that in turn enables political activism, both on the level of morale, in the sense that we are doing something really important and powerful in these cities, flows straight into politics, and in addition, some of the entertainers and cultural leaders, and certainly the writers, are very much involved in NAACP and CORE and the other activist organizations that are developing in the black communities of the North.
Well, let's talk briefly about this white migration, and you write that it has less of a dramatic impact on American politics and culture, but it certainly has some. And why is it that it doesn't have as much of an impact as the black concentration and black immigration to urban areas of America has on the development of American politics?
Well, Well, that's part of my point about political geography that I think is pretty interesting. You know, so white Southerners outnumber black Southerners moving north and west by 2-1. And you would think, therefore, they would have twice the political impact, but that's not at all the case. It has something to do with where they're settling. Whereas black Southerners are moving into a discrete number of big cities and are forced by racial segregation to live together and develop a politics together, white Southerners are spreading out, mostly to suburbs and small cities. You know, so in the Oregon area, white Southerners are all up and down the timber towns, and as well as in Portland, whereas black Southerners would be living just in Portland. And that, and there's a, it's a less empowering geography in much of the 20th century to be living in the suburbs. And white Southerners are tending to kind of interact with and settle in and integrate with other whites, whereas blacks by are forced to develop a community and a politics all by themselves. So the force of racism and the force of geography combine to make this opening for a powerful black political impact and a much less significant white Southern impact.
Well, Jim, do you think it's this the force of racism and geography that has something to do with the enduring power of the white South in American politics? I mean, does the migration say anything about this persistence power of white Southerners way out of proportion to their percentage of the population?
Well, in an indirect way, part of what my book is doing is showing the transformation of northern and western spaces, a kind of southernization, if you will, certainly a reorganization of the ways of life in the North and the West, and of politics too. And all of that is sort of helping to go to circle back and transform the South at the same time. And so the South is undergoing a transformation that sort of will bring the two regions kind of more together, more like each other, certainly by the end of the 1970s and 1980s. And that all has set up the white South to return to power in a way that we haven't seen since before the Civil War, really. And so it's not that my book actually explains that, but it sort of sets up an understanding of how we've, in the last quarter of a century, moved to this powerful Sunbelt South that leads, that dominates the political system.
Yes, yes. And thank you so much, James, for writing this book. It's fascinating. And thanks so much for joining us on KBOO today. I've been speaking with Jim Gregory, author of The Southern Diaspora, How the Great Migrations of Black and White Southerners Transformed America. This is Laurie Mercier for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
And I had some money in the bank. I got busted, baby, ain't that bad. You can't lose what you ain't never had.
KBOO Portland, that was Laurie Mercier talking with James Gregory about his new book, sounds very interesting, The Southern Diaspora, How the Great Migrations of Black and White Southerners Transformed America. Well, this coming Saturday, March 4th at 12 noon, there'll be a gathering for immigrant rights at Pioneer Courthouse Square. Respect all workers, no human being is illegal. Immigration rights are on the front burner in most states currently. And on the line I have Erica Steinbauer. She's the co-founder of CAUSA and working hard to bring some justice for day laborers and other migrant workers. Erica, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here, and I'm actually the coordinator of CAUSA.
Coordinator, okay, thanks. We talked briefly last night, last minute. I appreciate you joining us. It's great to be able to get folks information about things that are happening, actions that people can take. Can you talk about CAUSA and what the organization is and a little bit about what they do, and then we can jump into some of these topics, particularly the Sensenbrenner bill, and perhaps also I'd like to talk about the Bush immigration reform and some of the differences there.
Sure. Well, CAUSA is Oregon's Immigrant Rights Coalition. We're based out of Salem, and we work with groups in Medford, Eugene, Portland, and other areas of the state. And we work on the federal level for a just legalization program, and we have also worked in defense of immigrant rights at the state level. And we're working with a number of immigrant rights groups, religious groups, and labor groups in Portland in a coalition that's actually being led by VOS, which is the day labor organization, to organize this mass mobilization on Saturday.
And the mobilization is specifically to bring attention, draw attention to the Sensenbrenner bill that
Go ahead. Well, I was just going to, in the U.S. House, a bill was proposed by Congressman Sensenbrenner, who is an extremely anti-immigrant congressman, who also was one of the sponsors of the Real ID Act, which passed in May, which some people may be familiar with. And so that bill passed in Congress just 10 days after it was introduced in December. And it's really the harshest immigration bill in the last 70 years that we've seen. If you want, I can just go through a couple of the most troubling
provisions. That would be great,
okay.
Yeah.
One of the more troubling provisions is that it would make any relative employer, coworker, or even pastor of an undocumented immigrant, an alien smuggler by definition, and therefore a criminal. And this is really just shifting the United States in the direction of an immigration police state. The other really bad provision is that, right now there's 11 million immigrants in the United States who are undocumented, either because they don't qualify for legal status or because they're in one of the really long waiting lines waiting to get legal status. And this would make those 11 million immigrants, many of whom are workers that put the food on the table, criminals who would be permanently barred from ever legally immigrating. Just a couple other things. It would turn state and local police into immigration agents, and this is particularly troubling to those of us in Oregon because we've worked hard to retain a provision, Statute 181 in Oregon law, that prohibits local police from collaborating with INS, and this would overrule that. It would also force employers to verify workers' immigration status, but using a really flawed database system. So those are some of the worst provisions of the Sensenbrenner bill. Overall, we just don't think that it's an acceptable way to go about solving what's a really serious problem with the American immigration system. And we're working on a national level to promote reforms that give a pathway to citizenship for workers, that reunite families and reduce the backlogs, and that give immigrant workers the same protections as American workers.
Are there significant differences between what the Bush administration proposed and the Sensenbrenner bill that are noteworthy, or are they pretty much compatible programs?
So the Sensenbrenner bill is actually more of a border security bill, and it doesn't really, the whole problem with it is that it's not comprehensive. It doesn't address the issue, which is that there's 11 million undocumented people here. It just wants to turn them into criminals and deport them. The Bush administration is, and they don't actually have a proposal, but they've just come out in favor of a guest worker proposal that would let workers have legal status, like temporary legal status, for 3 years. They could renew it for another 3 years, but then they couldn't stay. And we don't think it's just if you're here and you're your work is contributing to the prosperity of the country and you want to stay here with your family, we think you should be able to have an earned pass towards citizenship, and that's not in line with what the Bush administration so far has been supporting.
Also, for listeners who want to get more information, detailed information about both Bush's immigration reform, the Sensenbrenner bill, and much more legislation and other proposals, you can go to PCUN's website, which is PCUN.org. Quickly, when people gather this Saturday at noon at Pioneer Courthouse Square, what does CASA and the other organizations hope to achieve? What is the goal?
We're hoping to just mobilize the immigrant community and mobilize the ally community to send a really strong message to the Senate right now, because the Senate Judiciary Committee will be taking up immigration reform probably by the end of this week. And the proposal they're starting with, which is called a chairman's mark, doesn't have a pathway to citizenship for the 11 million undocumented. It would place them in a kind of permanent second-class status. And so we want to send a strong message to our senators that Oregonians believe in a just legalization program and a just comprehensive immigration reform, and we want them to vote accordingly and not support a Sensenbrenner-like amendments if they come up in the Senate.
Great. Well, I'll remind folks again at the end of the show what's happening this Saturday. And Erica, thank you very much for joining us, and good luck this week in organizing.
Thanks so much for having me.
Okay.
This is Fran Michelle, here to discuss Portgate. And today, the well-read Red has some shocking news. According to the New York Times, George W. Bush has suggested that criticism of the deal that would give a Dubai company management of a number of American ports may have racial overtones. The irony of Bush positioning himself as defender of the dignity and rights of Arabs seems to have been lost on almost everyone but Molly Ivins, whose outrage is sufficiently unfatigued to still register in a column on workingforchange.com that this is Mr. Racial Profiling speaking, the man who has single-handedly created more Arab enemies for this country than anyone else ever dreamed of doing. The ports in question are currently managed by a British company, and its sale to DP World, a corporation based in and owned by the United Arab Emirates, has people across the political spectrum focusing on whether an Arab company operating commercial ports is a threat to our national security. This focus emerges from and is fueling anti-Arab and anti-Arab American sentiment. Surprisingly enough, the fact that Bush says something doesn't necessarily make it false. The Arab American Anti-Discrimination Committee, in a statement on their website, adc.org, notes that they are strongly opposed to the rhetoric and bias surrounding the company solely because it is Arab-owned. Those who purport that ports can be securely run by a British company, but not an Arab one, are engaging in racial profiling on the corporate level. Laila Al-Khatami, spokeswoman for the ADC, reports in an interview with Katrina Vandenhoevel of The Nation that her inbox is full of emails telling Arabs to stay away and we don't want your money in the U.S., and Al-Khatami notes, those are the nice ones. Vandenhoevel calls on us all to continue to issue a clarion call against destructive anti-Arab and anti-Arab American sentiment that threatens to take our nation even further backwards in our continuing struggle for civil and human rights. And she cautions, when the president suddenly attempts to wax eloquent about prejudice against a Middle Eastern company, let's not be fooled about his true motives or lose sight of the real issues. So what might those true motives be? Maximizing corporate profits comes to mind. The Bush administration has significant business ties to DP World. According to the New York Daily News, David Sanborn, who runs DP World's European and Latin American operations, was named by Bush to direct the U.S. Maritime Administration just last month. And Treasury Secretary John Snow, who headed the federal review of the deal, was chairman of CSX, which sold its international port operations to DP World for $1.15 billion just 1 year before Snow joined the Bush cabinet. Naranjan Ramakrishnan, writing in Counterpunch, points out that for the current administration, defending America is less important than defending free trade, and the money saved by outsourcing can go to tax cuts. Dick Rivas, also writing in Counterpunch with a similar sense of sarcasm, says the ports dispute raises two questions that have gone unasked. The first of them is that if, as almost all public parties to the dispute agree, privatizing seaport management to state-owned foreign companies is a good idea, why stop at the water's edge? Indeed, why stop with ports? Dozens of other inefficient government functions are crying to be privatized too, and doing so would rid our government of deficits, making room in our budget for a new round of tax cuts. Among the money losers are the following agencies whose best chance for a return to profitability lies with privatization to the following nations. The Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms to Russia, which since 1991 has led the world in the sale of arms to non-state purchasers. The Department of Defense to China, whose Red Army, with its corps of real estate captains and joint venture colonels, has led the way in making military forces pay for themselves. The Office of the Presidency to Cuba, whose leadership has provided stability and continuity to its people for half a century. Of course, Rivas's examples resonate because Russia, China, and Cuba have for years been demonized, as Arab nations are being demonized now. He continues, these proposals have for some time been percolating in the hallways of Washington and the break rooms of banking houses in New York, and thus far only one challenge has presented itself, an answer to the second of the important questions that the seaport controversy raises. It is this. If our government should outsource the management of inefficient state-owned facilities and programs, as with our seaports, to foreign companies that are also state-owned, how can those guys make them profitable when we can't? More seriously, John Nichols, writing in The Nation, argues that the problem isn't that the corporation is Arab-owned. The problem is that it's a corporation. He writes, ports are essential pieces of the infrastructure of the United States, and they are best run by public authorities that are accountable to elected officials and the people those officials represent. While traditional port authorities still exist, they are increasingly marginalized as privatization schemes have allowed corporations, often with tough anti-union attitudes and even tougher bottom lines, to take charge of more and more of the basic operations at the nation's ports. There are two fundamental facts about corporations that put this controversy about who runs the ports in perspective. First, like most American firms, most Arab-owned firms are committed to making money, and the vast majority of them are not about to compromise their potential profits by throwing in with terrorists. Second, like most American firms, Arab-owned firms are more concerned about satisfying shareholders than anything else. As such, they are poor stewards of ports and other vital pieces of the national infrastructure that still require the constant investment of public funds, as well as responsible oversight by authorities that can see more than a bottom line, in order to maintain public safety, not to mention the public good of modern, efficient transportation services. For the Well-Read Red, this has been Fran Michelle.
This is the Old Mole Variety Hour, February 27th. We're closing out the month. Next up, we've got Bill Resnick. He's going to be talking with Chris Tonsig, editor of Middle East Report.
Thanks, Denise, and thanks to all the other old moles today. Chris Tonsig is the editor of the journal Middle East Report, has written a good deal in left journals over the years. Chris Tonsig, welcome to KABU here in Portland.
Thanks, Bill. Thanks for having me.
Last week, the Middle East, and in fact the whole international system, was shaken by what Gilbert Achkar, in his book with that title, called The Clash of Barbarisms, and sort of the maneuvers of both Judeo-Christian imperialism and fundamentalist Islam and their struggles. It happened in the Port of Dubai thing. It's happened the cartoons of Muhammad and Israel-Palestine with the Israeli rejection of Hamas. It's happened in Iraq in somewhat different form. Chris Tonsig, maybe explain the idea of the clash of barbarisms and how it played out last week.
Well, I think what's happening in Iran, Iraq, and Israel-Palestine, those things all have their own dynamics, their own local dynamics that are driving those stories. But certainly you see in the cartoon controversy, more than anything else, the sad fact that several years after September 11th, the predictions of a clash of civilizations and the idea that those attacks were somehow a manifestation of a clash of civilizations between Islam and the West, those have become essentially a self-fulfilling prophecy, in large part because of the policies that the United States has pursued since the September 11th attacks, which have succeeded in convincing a lot of people in the Islamic world that Islam, civilization, and the people are under attack from the West. And that feeling is, of course, exploited to the hilt and has been propounded for many years by people like Osama bin Laden, but other Islamist ideologues, including the president of Iran and his hardline supporters in that government. They have always been propagating this idea that that the difference between the Muslim world and the West is a civilizational one, an irreducible cultural difference, and this plays right into their hands. The policies of the Bush administration have in many ways played right into their hands. So it's just very sad to see this occurring. In manifesting itself in so many ways, I wish I could say it's surprising. The Bush administration really set the tone for this, of course, with the ill-chosen term crusade that escaped Bush's lips early after the September 11th attacks, and then with the whole rhetoric of you're with us or you're against us.
Mm-hmm.
That has really been the kicker in turning this clash of civilizations rhetoric into somewhat of a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Right. Look, well, the cartoon thing seems to me, that Danish right-wing paper, then supported by the right-wing all over Europe, is sort of there claiming their free speech rights and how they're being, and how this liberal and constitutional free speech civilizations of the West are in a war with these benighted, superstitious, fundamentalist, crazy groups in the Mideast, and propagating that sort of that holy war spirit through their own, through the cartooning. It seems to me that's another sign of that, the provocative attitudes by the sort of the Western imperialists.
Yeah, I think the decision of the Danish newspaper to print those cartoons is a perfect example of what you're talking about. I certainly support the right of that newspaper to be juvenile idiotic. One has the right to be juvenile idiotic. That doesn't mean that you should be. They displayed remarkably poor editorial discretion at best. And then if you understand the context of the printing of those cartoons, the fact that the same newspaper had rejected caricatures of God making fun of Christianity only a year earlier, then you understand that that this was much more than just trying to test the boundaries of free speech. This was a calculated insult in many ways certainly to the Danish Muslim community, and then it became a calculated insult to the rest of the Islamic world. Of course, in the context, not just the content of those cartoons, but also the context in which they appeared, also renders them, you know, something considerably more than just the exercise of free speech. That they're playing on various racial and religious stereotypes that have been used to justify actual physical violence against Muslims.
Right. Although then, of course, these cartoons are used by it seems to me, the worst elements of the Arab world or the Islamic world to then rally their troops in these, in some countries, anti-Christian sort of rioting and killing, and then Christians fighting back. And in some countries like Iraq, just using Islamic fundamentalism and the blasphemy against the Prophet as a way of cementing their own militias and attacking the, you know, other militias, like the Sunni Shiite thing in Iraq. They whip up to a frenzy their forces as part of sort of sectarian warfare, even inter-Islamic.
Yes, I mean, the Iranian president certainly has played it to the hilt in terms of his demagoguery and appropriating these cartoons for his own purposes, the purposes of consolidating the power of a hardline regime and also leading Iran into what increasingly appears to be a potentially disastrous confrontation with the West over the nuclear issue. And that is what he has done is equally irresponsible as what is happening in the West by printing those cartoons. And of course, the problem is compounded with regard to the Iranian president by his liberal use of anti-Semitic slurs and questioning the Holocaust and other things like that that play to the baser political currents in the Islamic world. So, the cartoon crisis especially has brought out some of the uglier dimensions of our world on all sides.
On all sides, including, of course, the Israeli rejectionists, that is, or the expansionists, or the most sort of racist, anti-Arab, take their land forces in Israel, are overjoyed by the whole thing because they can sort of paint, therefore, Hamas, which is a complex organization, just as another set of crazed terrorists, and which, you know, doing that, of course, then permits them to both ethnically cleanse new areas and continue settlements and build up their army and attack and assassinate.
Well, certainly the conventional wisdom immediately after the Hamas victory in the PLC elections was that this would bolster the fortunes of the Likud party of Netanyahu in the upcoming elections in Israel for the Knesset. But in fact, what seems to have occurred is that the Hamas victory has bolstered further the chances, which were already quite good, of the Kadima party that was started by Ariel Sharon shortly before he had his incapacitating stroke and now has been passed on to the leadership of Ehud Olmert, his former deputy prime minister. And the logic that has been greatly strengthened in Israel by the victory of Hamas, which of course has pledged that it will not negotiate with Israel at least until such time as the occupation of the lands occupied in the 67 war ends, The logic of the Kadima Party is unilateral separation from the Palestinians, not holding out really any hope, at least in the medium term, of a negotiated peace with the Palestinians, or even some kind of coexistence, but rather separation behind the wall that Israel is erecting at a furious pace in the West Bank and East Jerusalem. And today, the Israeli Defense Minister Mofaz has been more explicit than any top Israeli political figure has been in the past about the number of West Bank settlement blocks and the names of the West Bank settlement blocks that will be included behind the wall eventually when Israel completes it. And those include the settlement of Ariel, which is very deep in the West Bank in occupied territory. So it appears that that is the logic that has been strengthened by the Hamas victory. That is to say, conflict management rather than conflict resolution, and managed structural violence rather than peace.
Mm-hmm. This is KBOO Radio 90.7 FM. Bill Resnick talking to Chris Tonsig. Chris is the editor of Middle East Reports, writes a lot on the Middle East. It was a very bleak week with the, it seems to me, the worst forces on all sides greatly strengthened and ready to undertake their sort of mutual, their various wars. Chris, what's the, how can that be responded to? What does the secular left in the Middle East, I mean, this, they've been facing this for a long time. This is just sort of an escalation of what's been happening. How do they, what are the ideas for responding to the kind of clash of barbarisms?
Well, I think the first task of the secular left or secular folks in general, both in the Muslim world and here in the West, is first of all to insist on a historical understanding of all of these apparent clashes of civilizations that have arisen. And in the case of Iraq, something we haven't touched on yet, but the sectarian violence that has arisen in the past week, it's very important to understand that this is not a flare-up of some timeless tribal ethnic hatreds that are primordial and immutable and never change over time. That's not what's happening. Rather, these are political conflicts which have been framed by demagogues in religious and sectarian terms. And the decisions of political elites, including Saddam Hussein, including the Iraqi allies of the United States after the fall of Saddam Hussein, and including the United States itself, its own policies when it was the direct occupying power in Iraq, have been the thing that has set the stage for this sectarian violence. And minus those political calculations by elites, and minus the dynamic that was set in place by those decisions, there is no reason why Iraq would be spiraling toward a sectarian civil war at this stage. It's very important to resist the idea that that these hatreds, whether that be between Sunni and Shia in Iraq and elsewhere in the Islamic world, or between Israelis and Palestinians, or between Muslims and non-Muslims, it's very important to resist the idea that these things are primordial, immutable, and changeless. Mm-hmm. Because the corollary of saying that these are 1,000-year-old hatreds, which have always existed, is to say that they will always be with us, and that's simply there's no reason to believe that.
Yeah, in fact, in Iraq, one of the reasons that the whole thing is so intractable is that for quite a long time, Sunnis and Shiites were living together in quite peaceful communities. Particularly in Baghdad, but lots of other places in the north of Iraq, at least, where they lived together amicably, and And we're now separating them would be basically create a kind of civil war situation and vast amounts of death. But in fact, that there was no, the Shiite Sunni thing was in fact based, at least for in those communities, quite settled and in peaceable ways.
Well, one should be careful not to project a false memory of perfect communal peace back
right.
Onto Iraq, and that there has been enmity and there has been inequality between Sunni Arabs and
right.
Shiite Arabs for some time. Although, of course, that doesn't mean that every Sunni Arab has been privileged and every Shiite Arab has not been. That doesn't work that way. But it's really the regime of Saddam Hussein, especially in its later desperate years, that really played the sectarian and also the tribal card very over and over repeatedly, and turned the Iraqi regime that fell into what could be described as a sectarian regime. It's been the policies of that regime that really laid the groundwork, and then the U.S. policies have exacerbated those existing mm-hmm. tensions very greatly.
Yeah.
But it is true, on the other side of the coin, is that it's very true that there has been a tremendous amount of intermarriage among Sunni and Shiite Arabs in Iraq for several generations now. There isn't some kind of timeless and universally observable difference between those communities that has kept them in each other's throats in all periods of Iraqi history. Quite the contrary.
Mm-hmm.
So these hatreds arise for historically contingent reasons. That have much more to do with politics, distribution of resources, and political economy.
Right. In fact, you can say the same about Iran, right? I mean, in the 50s and 60s, there were powerful secular movements and labor movements that, in fact, won elections. And then, of course, came the U.S. coup against Mohammad Mossadegh installation of the Shah of Iran, which then strengthened the mullahs. It seems to me, in Iran, though, even still, it seems to me there's tremendous secular forces, even though they're being deeply repressed.
There are secular forces in Iran, as there are in Iraq and elsewhere. But you touched on a very important point for understanding the rise of sectarianism and religious identity, Islamism, in the entirety of the Islamic world in the last 30 years, and that has been the very calculated decision of the political elites in that part of the world, backed assiduously by the United States for many years, to crush the secular left and the labor movement, the independence of the labor movement, and in particular socialist influences. Those were systematically crushed by governments from Egypt to Pakistan, with a wink and a nod from the U.S. As part of a Cold War logic, and the forces that were strengthened as a result, sometimes as a matter of overt policy by these states, were the Islamist forces that now have come back to bite the states in the rear end.
Right. Chris, I'm afraid we're going to have to close. We don't have... It'd be great, though, to talk about not just sort of the historical memory of the repression of the secular left, but what sorts of policies, and it's not inconceivable, the Western progressives could employ to assist those forces and to build a different kind of Middle East regimes. Chris Stonesink, thanks a lot for talking to us.
No problem. Anytime.
Right. So long.
Bye-bye.
Charming. Someone to feel handsome, very much here. Either dancing through fire or a Babylon, world famous clear, something to charm, danger, someone to harm, falling into the mire, climbing higher and higher, someone to feel handsome, very much here, evil, dancing through fire, or a Babylon, world famous clear, ivory tower, longing for something now, waiting. A prison of sorts. Only the rich make the laws, using repression and force. All of Babylon, city of quartz, someone to feel hidden and very much here. Hatred summons so near. Horror of Babylon.
Well, that's it for the Old Mole Variety Hour this morning. Wanted to remind everyone that this Saturday, March 4th at 12 noon, Pioneer Courthouse Square, there'll be a gathering, a march for immigrant rights. Respect all workers. No human being is illegal. For more information, you can go to www.pcun.org. Thanks. We'll see you again next week.
Tuned to KBOO Portland Community Radio. It is time now for Health Watch. Today, Dr. David Naiman interviews herbalist and writer Andrew Gedart, author of Healing Skin Disorders, Natural Treatments for Dermatological Conditions. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from The Way of Health, a nonprofit health clinic emphasizing internal medicine, including special programs for mental health issues, such as depression or anxiety, Chinese medicine, and acupuncture. The Way of Health is located at the corner of Southeast Market at 106th Avenue in Portland. Information at 503-788-4165. And don't forget that at 10:30, Earthwatch comes up today, hosted by Chris Andre. And at 11 o'clock, Democracy Now! Features information about total information awareness, a plan to create the world's largest surveillance database to track everything that you do. Look forward to that. Here comes Earth Health Watch.